We
are.
We
are.
We are cultivate.
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 We are cultivate.
Hello and welcome to Ye Olde Crime, where we discuss the funny, strange, and obscure crimes of yesteryear. I'm your host, Lindsay Valenti, and with me is my sister and co-host, Maddie Stengel.
Hello.
Well, hello there.
Yeah.
It has been a day.
It's been a week.
Yeah.
We're 2 days past when we typically record. Like, that's just how off we both are.
So, like, literally after we are done recording this, I need to start editing it because it's due tomorrow. So,
anyway, I guess we should do a podcast, right?
Yeah, I know. So, it is the first podcast episode of the month, which means it is time for us to thank our supporters over on Buy Me a Coffee. So thank
nice.
You.
Nice.
Thank you. You can join their ranks by signing up as a monthly sustainer for either $1 or $5 a month over at buymeacoffee.com/yeoldcrime. All right. This one is a bit of a doozy, so buckle up.
Doozy in what way? Doozy in like long or doozy in like gross?
Long. This is going to be a long one. So today we will be discussing Jane Toppin.
That's a nice name. Was she not nice?
She was not. I'm glad that you didn't recognize it because this is one of the slightly more well-known older cases. So I'm happy. All right.
You watch. All right. It's going to be like halfway through and I'll be like, oh. No. This Jane Toppin.
Information was pulled from the following sources: a 2024 Irish Central article by Kate Hickey, 2023 New England Historical Society article, 2022 Lowell Historical Society article, 2009 Mental Floss article by Miss Selenia, a 1938 The Boston Globe article, 1902 JAMA. JAMA Network article. I don't know how to properly say that, so I'm just going to spell it.
It's JAMA.
Okay. I'm glad you know. Mm-hmm. 1902, the St. Paul Globe article, Crime Museum, Find a Grave, Murderpedia, and Wikipedia.
Ooh, dang. She is notorious, huh?
Yep.
She's got all the pedias.
And links to all of these articles will be included in the show notes. Got something you want to say? Shoot us an email over at yeoldcrimepodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your story ideas, see any gifts you send our way, or if you just want to say hello. We're pretty friendly. Speaking of friendly, if you'd like to have real-time conversations with us, consider joining our Discord over at the Cultivate Network. You can chat with us over at the Old Crimers Cubby, or catch up with any of the other great creators that are part of the Cultivate family of podcasts. Just click the link in our show notes, or over on our link tree to get started today. Jane Toppin was born Honora Kelly on March 31st, 1854, in the north end of Boston, Massachusetts, to poor Irish immigrants Peter Kelly and Bridget Finn Kelly. Her year of birth has been contested, as on many official documents it is listed as 1857. And given the timeline of her life events, that's the year that I'm going to go off of, is 1857.
Okay.
So it's wrong on Wikipedia.
Oh, no. We don't have a right birth date for a woman in history? That's crazy. That never happened.
It's crazy.
It's crazy.
She was one of four girls, and when she was just a year old, her mother passed away from tuberculosis, leaving her and her sisters in her father's care. And according to the Lowell Historical Society, she had an older sister named Ellen, or Nellie, and Delia, making her one of the youngest. So I don't know if there was another one in between or after. I have no idea where the fourth sister falls in this.
Okay.
In February of 1863, her father took her and her older sister Delia to an orphanage in Boston's South End called the Boston Female Asylum.
So he didn't take all of them, he just took half?
He just took half of them.
That's fucked.
The mission of the asylum was to, quote, receive, protect, and instruct female orphans until the age of 10 years when they are placed in respectable families, end quote.
Creepy. So this was like some weird boot camp on how to be the perfect child slash probably indentured servant.
Yes, that's the one.
Before you were sold off. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This may or may not be human trafficking.
Yeah. So I think the reason he only brought those two is I think the oldest was too old to be in the asylum. That's my thought, is she wouldn't have been young enough to be admitted.
Got it. So she was just sold off right away.
I mean, I don't know. Or she was old enough to be helpful and he kept her around to help take care of the other sister. I have no idea.
The other one.
Peter, their father, was known as Kelly the Crack, as in crackpot. And even though he was a tailor by trade, he did not make enough to provide for 3 to 4 children.
That makes sense. I feel like a lot of tailors and like shoemakers and stuff, it really wasn't a very lucrative profession. Nothing was really a very lucrative profession back then.
So he couldn't provide for his kids and also support his drinking habit at the same time.
Oh, well, that's the most important piece.
There are unsubstantiated rumors that he also attempted to sew his own eyelids shut at one point. So there's that as well. Adding to the crackpot nickname.
That's horrific.
Yeah, which is fun. In the New England Historical Society article, it said that Honora was 6 and her older sister Delia was 8 at the time they were dropped off at the asylum. And that's kind of why I'm going based off of the 1857 date, because if we look at her birthday, if it was from 1854, her older sister would have already been aged out of the system. So it makes more sense.
So then, yeah, it does make more sense. But oh my God, she'd have to be there for 4 years.
Yeah. At some point, the girl's paternal grandmother raised them for a short time. And it's unclear if the other two siblings continued to be in her care after Honora and Delia were left at the Boston Female Asylum. So I don't know if he still raised the other two or if his mother did. I don't know.
I bet you that was probably what ended up happening, though.
Yeah.
So he had to get rid of all of them.
According to the New England Historical Society, older sister Delia remained at the asylum until 1868, when she was hired out as a servant in New York at the age of 12. She went on to become a sex worker and eventually died as an alcoholic. And their other sister, Nellie, who was also older, wound up in an insane asylum with their father later in life.
Oh, that's sad. So not a good track record so far. You either die young or become an alcoholic and
end up in a not fun place.
Yeah.
Honora would go on to become the indentured servant of widow Anne C. Toppin of Lowell, Massachusetts, in November of 1864. So she would have been 7 at the time.
Oh my God.
She was passed off as an Italian girl whose family had died at sea. Being Irish came with a stigma. So in addition to passing her off as Italian, they renamed her Jane Jenny Toppin, although she was never formally adopted by them.
Interesting.
She was also a servant to the Toppin's daughter, Elizabeth, who was 21 years Jane's senior. So she was already an established adult.
Having a very small child be her, like, lady-in-waiting, essentially.
I don't know how much Elizabeth was living in the Toppin home at the time, as she was employed as a teacher. So I don't know if she had her own home at that point or if she was still living with her mother.
Okay.
Unclear. Jane was sent to school, where she did very well and made a number of friends. But according to Mrs. Toppin, Jane gained weight while at school, making her, quote, unattractively fat, end quote.
Cute. Mm-hmm. And then I bet you she was, like, a healthy weight.
Yeah. If you look at photos of her, she was fine. In her teen years, Jane exhibited some of the telltale signs of a sociopath, telling a number of outrageous lies, such as that her brother was decorated at Gettysburg by President Lincoln, and that her father worked in China 2 years before marrying her mother.
Mm.
Jane graduated from Lowell High School, and at the age of 18, she was freed from her indenture to the Toppins and given $50, or almost $1,300 today, to kind of go and start her life fresh.
I mean, that's kind of nice, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Instead of leaving, Jane chose instead to stay with the Toppins as their servant until she was forced from the home at the age of 25.
Oh, yeah. Because she'd be a Thornback at that point, right?
I think so.
So having a Thornback servant in your house probably didn't look good.
In 1885, when she was 28, Jane started training as a nurse at Cambridge Hospital, where she earned the nickname Jolly Jane for her bubbly personality. She was a bit of a gossip and delighted in making fun of the students who were dismissed if they happened to be on her bad side.
Cute.
Yeah. She also continued her lying streak, going so far as saying that the Tsar of Russia had once offered her a nursing post.
Sure.
Yeah.
Because she was really good. She was really good with blood disorders at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Add to this the fact that she likely stole small items from the hospital, and it's easy to understand why many of her fellow trainees really didn't like her.
Yeah.
Fun fact, she was obsessed with autopsies, poisonous drugs, and their antidotes, to the point that even hospital administration began to be concerned.
That's bad.
Mm-hmm. Of course, they didn't know that she had already started to experiment with morphine and atropine on the elderly patients in her care, and would later graduate to strychnine as well.
Okay. Are you familiar at all with atropine?
I am going to explain what all those drugs mean in just a second and what they do.
Because that's holy smokes.
Yep.
Oh my God.
So, according to the drug bank, quote, high doses of atropine may cause palpitation, dilated pupils, difficulty swallowing, hot, dry skin, thirst, dizziness, restlessness, tremor, fatigue, and ataxia. Toxic doses of atropine lead to restlessness and excitement, hallucinations, delirium, and coma, end quote.
Yeah. It's quite literally to jumpstart your body again.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really, really, really painful. Like that first dose when it hits and your heart regulates its beat for the first time, it's incredibly painful.
According to the DEA, quote, overdose effects of morphine include cold and clammy skin, lowered blood pressure, sleepiness, slowed breathing, slow pulse rate, coma, and possible death, end quote.
So she just loved playing with the extremes.
Yep. And finally, according to the CDC, quote, strychnine is rapidly absorbed after ingestion, inhalation, or intravenous administration. It causes generalized muscle spasms, muscle cramps, stiffness and tightness, agitation, heightened awareness and responsiveness, respiratory failure, stimulation-sensitive seizures, and possibly death, end quote. So this is the one that's most, if you hear of cases where the person kind of like bows like a string, that's strychnine. That's one of the classic signs of strychnine poisoning, is when their body like just completely seizes.
It seizes really painfully and then that's how they die. Like,
yeah,
there's no undoing it. So you're just suffering for however long before you can't breathe anymore.
Yep. Ugh. She also would take their existing medications and she would give them like much higher doses of whatever their medication was. And then when they got worse, she would like nurse them back to health, or she would just be like, you know, this was fun. Goodbye.
So kind of like a different method of Munchausen's by proxy.
Yes. In 1887, a woman named Amelia Finney was recovering from surgery, and Jane was appointed as her nurse. She recalled that after her surgery, Jane gave her a dose of medicine that was quite bitter, which caused Amelia to pass out. During this time of unconsciousness, Jane climbed into Amelia's bed and kissed her all over her face. Before long, something startled Jane, and she stopped. When Amelia awoke the next morning, she determined that it was all likely a fever dream, and it wouldn't be until almost 15 years later that she'd learn it was anything but.
That's horrific.
After her training, which she was forced to leave without getting her certificate, but it's okay because she just forged it.
Right. It was so easy to do that then that you could be like, yeah, it's fine.
Yeah. Like she got like almost to the point where she was going to be given her certificate when they like let her go. And so she didn't get it. So she was like, it's fine. I'll just take care of it myself.
That would have been quite the FU.
Yeah. Jane secured a job at Massachusetts General Hospital in 1889, but was fired as a result of her providing an unwarranted amount of opiates to her patients, which was speculated as a way to disguise her own opium habit.
Yeah, and that would have been incredibly wasteful and expensive at the time. So they likely would have made it thinly veiled that they were helping her out, but they were just mad that she was spending too much of their money.
Even with this glaring breach in protocol, the doctors at Massachusetts General recommended her to their wealthy clients as a private nurse.
Just to get her out of their hair. Mm-hmm. They probably picked the people that they didn't like, too.
Well, because by all accounts, she was a good nurse. Like, people liked her. She had this bubbly personality. Off the clock, Jane enjoyed using gossip to turn her friends against one another, told dirty jokes, and imbibed copious amounts of beer.
Cute.
On the clock, she was a completely different story. Compassionate, cheerful, the very embodiment of a skilled medical professional.
Mm-hmm.
And unlike her peers, who earned on average $5 a week, or around $164 today, Jane was taking home $25 a week, or around $817 today, as a private nurse.
Yep, that makes sense.
Add to that the fact that she enjoyed a bit of a sexual thrill from climbing into bed with her patients as she killed them, and Jane was essentially getting her cake and eating it too.
It's clicking now who this person is.
Okay.
American Horror Story did a little thing with her.
Yes.
Yeah.
Some of her earliest victims were her elderly landlord and his wife, Israel Dunham, and his wife Lovely, who she disposed of one by one in 1895.
That's really cute that her name was Lovely.
I know. When asked later what happened to them, she stated that they were simply, quote, feeble and fussy, end quote, and, quote, old and cranky, end quote.
Oh, well, they're so cranky because you keep messing with their bodies.
Mm-hmm. Her classmates from nursing school would later recall how she used to say that there was no point in keeping the elderly alive.
Yeah. Honestly, there's a lot of people that believe that in that kind of field, and that's why they don't go far. They move on.
Yep.
With force.
Yes. Throughout Jane's time as a working woman, her foster sister Elizabeth would often reach out to her, asking if she'd like to come visit and stay at the family home. And it wasn't every time, but occasionally Jane would come and stay with her. Mm-hmm. In August of 1899, Jane was enjoying a summer vacation in Buzzards Bay when she invited Elizabeth to come stay with her at the Cape. Elizabeth had been complaining of depression, and Jane thought some fresh air and new scenery may do her some good.
Buzzards Bay, what a horrible name.
Right? It just sounds like
a place that's supposed to sound like nice and relaxing.
One day during Elizabeth's stay with Jane, the pair went to the beach to enjoy a picnic lunch of cold corned beef, taffy, and mineral water. Little did Elizabeth know that the water had in fact been laced with strychnine.
Cute.
Jane later recalled this moment, quote, "I held her in my arms and watched with delight as she gasped her life out," end quote.
That's messed up.
Now, at this point, you may be thinking to yourself, how is she getting these people to drink this stuff? Because it's bitter. Well, she would typically mix morphine with a fatal dose of atropine in a curative known as Hunyadi water. Now, Hunyadi water is still very much a thing and has been since 1863. Its two main ingredients are sodium sulfate and magnesium sulfate, and it was primarily prescribed by doctors as a way to cleanse the intestines as a natural purgative.
So it's a laxative.
Yes. And because of its taste, because it's already kind of naturally bitter.
She was able to hide.
Yes. That's why no one suspected it, because they knew it was in a taste bag. In February of 1900, Jane used strychnine to dispose of a close friend at St. John's Theological School in Cambridge, Miss Sarah E. Connors, so she could take over her post as the dining hall matron.
Cute.
And even though Jane did get the job, she soon lost it when administration was inundated with complaints about her incompetence at her post and the fact that money started going missing.
Oh, Jane.
In December of 1900, Mary McNear, a 70-year-old woman, fell ill during a visit to Cambridge. Her doctor sent along, quote, "one of his best nurses," end quote, to care for her at home. Jane would go on to poison Mary, who, by the way, was extremely wealthy, just 3 hours before she died.
Yeah. And it'd be hard. You could probably be suspicious during this time, but she's also a nurse caring for people who are really sick to start with. So it would be really hard to justify.
Well, and these were all spaced out too. So we're currently in 1900 and she started killing in 1895. So it hasn't been that many people yet, you know, over a 5-year span of time. So the summer after Elizabeth's death, Jane rented a cottage in Cambridge from Alden and Mattie Davis. Jane and the Davises knew each other quite well, as she had stayed at one of their cottages almost every summer for several years. So such as the one in Buzzards Bay.
She had a rapport with them.
Yep. So when Mattie injured herself falling down a flight of stairs, Jane came to the Davis home to offer her services to nurse her back to health.
Which you would take because you knew her and you trusted her and she had a good reputation. This is horrific. I'm already...
Despite her efforts, Mattie seemed to be getting worse. So Jane insisted that perhaps a change of scenery would do her good and took her to Cambridge to the cottage where she had originally been staying. Well, Mattie got a cocktail of morphine and atropine, which killed her after 2 days, with her passing on July 4th, 1901.
Oh my God, she had experience. I can't imagine what your body would feel like having both of those extremes attacking you at the same time. It'd probably feel like waves of both, you know, like your heart rate is slow to the point where you think you're going to die, and then it's racing to the point where you think you're going to die. Because I have no idea what that, like, the half-life would be with those drugs too, especially when mixed. Oh my God. Oh, 2 days of that. Like, best case scenario, you'd hope that it'd be like a minute and they would die.
But no, God. 2 days. Jane accompanied Maddie's body back to Katomet, Massachusetts for her burial. Following Maddie's death, Jane took it upon herself to take care of her widower, Alden, and she stayed at the home temporarily to offer her support.
Mm.
Not only that, but she also took care of his married daughters, Mary Minnie Davis Gibbs and Geraldine Davis Gordon, during her stay at their home. No. Of course, they had come home for the funeral.
Mm-hmm.
By July 29th, just a few weeks after her mother's passing, Geraldine was dead. And a few days after that, Alden passed, quote, from a stroke, end quote. And his last remaining daughter, Mary, passed away on August 19th.
That's crazy. Nobody suspected anything? Was there any sort of, like, common illness during that time, maybe? Like, I know tuberculosis was a long illness, but it was kind of petered out for the most part by then, right? By the 1890s?
Mm-hmm.
Fuck. So now she's just getting confident and sloppy.
Funnily enough, three mysterious fires also happened to occur in the Davis home at the same time that Jane was there.
She's like, you know, I'm bored with messing with people. Let's try fire.
Yep. But all were able to be put out with minimal damage done to the home.
Mm.
It also came out that Jane owed the Davis family $500, or $18,500 today, for her stay the summer of 1900, you know, the previous year.
Mm-hmm.
Following Alden's death, Jane had tried to get Mary to sign an agreement waiving the debt, which Mary refused to sign.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I bet at that point Mary was like, I need to get the fuck out of here.
Yep. Now, finally, someone spoke up and was like, that's suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
That someone was Mary's father-in-law, Captain Gibbs. He nice. Recalled that Mary had been in fine spirits and wasn't poorly at all prior to her untimely death. Like, he had talked to her, like, 2 days before she died.
Mm-hmm.
He found it interesting that of all the people that lived in the Davis home, Jane was the only one who was able to walk out alive, considering the rest of the family had all died within the span of just 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she should have, like, at least pretended to be sick or something at the time.
Yeah. He suspected that all of their deaths were foul play, so he took his concerns to a toxicologist, and he was able to get a judge to order that his daughter-in-law's body and the rest of the Davis family be exhumed for examination. An autopsy of all revealed that they had died as a result of atropine and morphine poisoning.
Jeez, how much would have to be in their bodies for them to still detect that, you know, that long?
One source said that he detected arsenic, and I was like, that wasn't her
MO.
What she used. That wasn't her MO. So I'm wondering if that was just
false positive, maybe?
Yeah.
Probably something. A contaminated sample.
Meanwhile, Jane had returned to Lowell and moved into Elizabeth's home in an effort to win the affections of her widower, Oramel Brigham.
What a name.
Right? Who, fun fact, was a deacon at the local church.
Mm.
Within 3 days of living in the home, she disposed of Edna Bannister, Oramel's 77-year-old sister, who, quote, died of heart failure, end quote.
Mm.
With Edna dead, Jane could impress Oramel with her homemaking skills and hopefully entice him to marry her.
Okay.
Unfortunately for Jane, Oramel made it very clear that he didn't want her as his housekeeper, and he definitely did not want her as his wife. For context, at this time, he was 69 and she was 43.
Yep.
He was like, yeah, no.
Like, my romancing days are done.
No, thank you.
And he was also maybe a decent man of God, if he said no.
Yeah. Undeterred, Jane decided to do what she did best, poison him, and then earn his love and affection as she nursed him back to health.
Wow.
Like, I saved you.
We love a good Stockholm syndrome.
Yep. When that plan also failed, she threatened to tell everyone that he had gotten her pregnant.
Cute.
And for Ormel, that was the final straw, and he ordered her to leave his home at the end of September 1901.
Okay.
Following her falling out with Ormel, Jane attempted suicide via an overdose of morphine, which landed her in the Lowell General Hospital under the care of Dr. Lathrop.
Yep, she would have known the perfect dose.
Yep. After attempting suicide once more at the hospital, one of the detectives that had been put on the case following the Davis family autopsies had himself admitted as a patient so he could keep an eye on Jane.
Nice.
Following her recovery and release, she went to visit her friend Sarah Nichols in Amherst, New Hampshire, where she lived with her brother. It was there that police were able to arrest Jane Toppin on October 29th, 1901. In the July 6th, 1902 edition of the St. Paul Globe, they shared this information about Jane following her arrest. Quote, Miss Toppin is 45 years old and has passed her life in towns in the vicinity of the murders. She is a member of the Congregational Church in Lowell. Her reputation among physicians and patients has been of the best. She is a large, kindly-faced woman with dark hair streaked with gray. Her face has a jolly, quizzical expression and outwardly bears no marks of a degenerate mind. End quote.
Well, she doesn't look crazy.
She looks fine.
She's just a cute little fat lady.
It's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Upon her arrest, Jane was assigned F.M. Bixby as her attorney. According to that same article in the St. Paul Globe, quote, when Miss Toppin made her startling confession to her chief counsel, former Judge Bixby of Lowell, she could not remember the names of all her victims, but she remembered having killed 31, end quote.
It was probably well more than that.
Jane sent a request to her childhood friend, James Stewart Murphy, in Lowell, to ask him to represent her in court. Mm-hmm. It has been speculated that he once had a crush on her, and it was noted that he was very friendly with her, and he would continue to be her friend even after the trial's conclusion.
Don't hit your buggy to her.
No, okay? Don't. Jane spent 7 months in jail prior to her trial. She was indicted for three of the murders of the Davis family, Alden, Mary, and Geraldine, but her trial was just for the murder of Mary Gibbs. Word of her arrest and the trial would eventually become international news.
Yeah.
In March of 1902, three doctors, Henry Stedman, George Jelly, and Hosea Quimby, evaluated Jane and determined that she was insane. Their findings were also based somewhat on the fact that she appeared to have mental health issues in her family history, which is fair.
If
two people that are directly related to her were institutionalized.
That's what pisses me off the most with a lot of like medical professionals that are murderers first, you know, like, or they're abusive. There are enough loopholes where they just essentially get a slap on the wrist.
Yep.
And it's a constant thing. And it's still happening to this day.
Yeah. During her examination, she was quoted as saying, quote, no voice has as much melody in it as the one crying for life. No eyes as bright as those about to become fixed and glassy. No face so beautiful as the one pulseless and cold, end quote.
Oh, that is terrifying. That is probably one of the scariest quotes I think I've ever heard.
It gave me goosebumps. Like, that's terrifying.
That's like talking to Jeffrey Dahmer.
Yeah.
And talking to him about his passion, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
My stomach flipped. And not in a good way.
No. Her trial took place on June 23rd, 1902. She confessed to her lawyer that she had killed at least 31 people, but it could have been as many as 100.
And it was probably more. You know, like being a liar like that, I bet she was really able to downplay a lot.
Mm-hmm. And if a lot of her patients were elderly, I'm sure there were many people that she killed prior to 1895 that were just written off as they passed from whatever, you know, under her care. And I'm going to share with you a partial list of her victims as noted on both Wikipedia and in the July 6th edition of the St. Paul Globe. So these are ones that were like confirmed to be tied to her. Okay. So we have Israel Dunham of Cambridge, who died on May 26th, 1895, aged 83. His cause of death was given as strangulated hernia. He was ill for 4 days, and Jane had nursed him. So that was her landlord. There is Lovely P. Dunham, wife of Israel, who died in Cambridge September 19th, 1897, aged 87. Her cause of death was listed as old age, and Jane had also nursed her. So she killed her 2 years after she killed her husband.
So that was when she was just starting to kind of, she wasn't confident yet.
Yes.
And she probably didn't get off on it as much as she did in the beginning. Like the thrill was still scary.
Yeah. Then we have Mrs. Brigham of Lowell, her foster sister Elizabeth, who died August 19th, 1899. She had 2 days of illness, and her cause of death was heart failure. And of course, Jane was in the house when she died and waited upon her as part during part of the time that she was ill.
So kind.
Then we have Mary McNear of Cambridge, the wealthy widow, who died on December 28th, 1900, age 70. She experienced 2 days of illness and passed from apoplexy. Jane nursed her for 3 hours before she died.
Oh, God. I'd hate to think of what she did to her during those 3 hours.
Yeah. Then we have Florence M. Calkins, who was a housekeeper for Elizabeth's husband in Lowell. She died January 15th, 1900, aged 45. She was sick for 3 days, and her cause of death is listed as heart failure. Jane was in the home when she died. So I'm assuming this happened at some point when she came back to visit Oramel prior to her being like, I want to be your wife.
I bet you for the majority of these, the reasons why they were able to pin it on her is because she was there.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably one of the few pieces that they could go off of. Because now I don't even think they probably would still say that's circumstantial.
Yeah. Then we have William H. Ingram of Watertown, who died January 27th, 1900, age 70. His cause of death was listed as heart failure. She had nursed him, so it must have been like she was his private nurse during that time.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have Sarah E. Connors, who was the matron of St. John's Theological School Refectory, who died in Cambridge on February 11th, 1900, aged 48. Cause of death was listed as complication of diseases under Jane's care. Maddie Davis of Katomet, who passed away on July 4th, 1901, aged 62. Her cause of death was listed as chronic diabetes.
Hey, say Maddie. That's how I'm going to die, no matter what. I could be in a car accident and they'll be like, due to complications from diabetes.
And we've got Genevieve Gordon of Chicago, who was the daughter of Alden Davis, died in Katomet on July 31st, 1901, had a short illness. There's no death certificate, and Jane had nursed her. We've got Alden Davis, who died in Katomet on August 8th, 1901. He was 65. He was ill for a few days, and there is no death certificate. And Jane nursed him during that time. We also have Mary E. Gibbs, who was the daughter of Alden Davis, died in Katomet on August 31st, 1901, aged 40. She was ill for 2 days, and there's no death certificate. And again, Jane nursed her. Last but certainly not least, we have Edna Bannister of Turnbridge, Vermont, the sister of Ormel, who died in Lowell on August 27th, 1901, age 77. She was sick for 2 days, and her cause of death is listed as heart failure. And of course, Jane was in the home when she passed. By her own account, Jane claimed that her killing spree started at the tender age of 16, when her then-boyfriend dumped her.
Okay.
According to her, a Lowell office worker had given her a promise ring, and then he moved to Holyoke, Massachusetts, where he fell in love with someone else and broke off their engagement.
This sounds like a big old lie.
Yeah.
That she was notorious for. Like, yeah. You're engaged at 16. Like, even then?
Yeah, on the one hand, I can see maybe this being true because she didn't start to exhibit her sociopathic tendencies until her teen years. So it's possible, but at the same time, I don't want to put a ton of weight to it because...
she was such a prolific liar.
Yeah, like, who knows?
Yeah, I have a feeling that this just isn't true just because of the types of lies she used to spout all the time. Like, I bet this was just a dude she was attracted to.
Who had no idea that she was attracted to him.
Mm-hmm. And she had developed, like, this whole storyline in her head. And...
Yep, yep. Jane was quoted as saying, quote, "If I had been a married woman, I probably would not have killed all of those people. I would have had my husband, my children, and my home to take up my mind," end quote.
I would kill them slowly.
When asked, how did you kill them? She responded, quote, "I gave them doses of morphine and atropine tablets in mineral water, and sometimes in a dilution of whiskey. Then I also used injections, just as I did at Katomet. I do not remember how I killed them all, but those that I recall were poisoned by atropine and morphine. My memory is not good. I forget some things," end quote.
Yeah, she'd definitely be a sociopath at that point if she's able to talk about them as if she were trying to recall a recipe.
Jane's trial lasted only 8 hours at the Barnstable County Courthouse.
Yeah, I bet.
After a jury deliberation of 27 minutes, they came back with the verdict that Jane Toppin was not guilty by reason of insanity.
They were like, "This bitch is crazy."
Yeah.
"Let's get her out of here, please. I've had goosebumps for 8 hours.
Yeah. Following the verdict, she was transported and institutionalized at Taunton State Hospital. According to the August 18th, 1938 edition of the Boston Globe, quote, "Though she appeared nearly normal at the time of her arrest and until after her committal, she developed delusions that somebody was trying to poison her and had to be placed in a straitjacket and be forcibly fed," end quote.
Yeah. I bet she was probably mostly afraid of herself and what she would do if she had access to things.
Mm-hmm. Jane died on August 17th, 1938, at the age of 81. She is buried at Mayflower Hill Cemetery in Taunton in the Potter's Field. An article about her passing was included in the August 18th, 1938 edition of the Boston Globe and includes in part the following. Quote, "The undertaker recalled that Jane had told him the family wished a large quantity of embalming fluid used." This is in reference to the Davis family. "She hoped that the fluid, containing a metallic poison, would destroy evidence of the other drugs she had used." So this could be where the arsenic thing came from.
Yeah. Because maybe it breaks it down, or even like, I wonder if arsenic would be part of that chemical mix potentially too. I don't know how those would break down in the body over time.
Yeah. And Folsom, the Harvard psychiatrist, later wrote in papers found among his effects after death, quote, "In the pleasure and excitement of crime, Jane Toppin seemed to find the criminal's enjoyment of doing artistic work to which danger appeared to add zest," end quote. A July 5th, 1902 article titled Jane Toppin, the Poisoner, notes the following, quote, The conviction and confession of the trained nurse, Jane Toppin, in Massachusetts, adds another to the notable cases of human crime. In fact, it stands alone in some respects. There is no closely parallel case. Homicidal impulses can exist with the most perfect apparent amiability, though this case is unique in some of its features. It is only a proof that the most dangerous morbid tendencies and an absence of moral control can exist with apparent perfect sanity. The case is an object lesson of one of the perils of society from unrecognized but dangerous mental abnormalities. End quote. And one final word from Jane herself about her evil deeds, quote, "That is my ambition, to have killed more people, more helpless people, than any man or woman who has ever lived," end quote.
Yeah, she was one of the first recorded angels of death, right?
And that is Jane Toppin.
By far one of my least favorite murderers. Like, there's just something so much more intense about masquerading as a caregiver in that way, you know, like mothers and stuff too, like, or like people who have foster children and like kill them and stuff. There's just something darker than just like killing people to rob them, or there's a very special place in whatever afterlife you believe in for people like that.
I agree. If you want a playlist of all our episodes on YouTube, click the link in our show notes or in our link tree and subscribe today for not only a list of our full catalog, but a separate list as well, just of our Can You Crack the Cramp Word segments.
Hello, twisted humans. Do you find yourself wanting to know more about the latest murder, conspiracy, cult, or haunting?
Then this is the podcast for you.
In 1952, there was a record high of UFOs reported. 1,500 sightings.
There has been evidence of human sacrifice, devil worship, and it is haunted by more spirits than can be counted.
A family of two adults and two kids reportedly saw a giant flying thing with glowing red eyes.
And meanwhile, the family's nanny that helped Veronica to care for her and Lucian's children was found bludgeoned to death in the basement of their family home. I'm Alicia.
And I'm Sierra. And this is Twisted and Uncorked.
This month's podcast plug is the Twisted and Uncorked podcast. From Victoria, British Columbia and Cincinnati, Ohio, Alicia and Sierra have a twisted fascination with the dark, spooky, and unimaginable. Every Tuesday, they rotate through categories including conspiracy, cult, disappeared, haunted, murderless, serial killer, unsolved, and listener suggested. And we will have a link to their show in the show notes.
Nice.
And this week's listener question comes from a new listener from Canada.
Oh, wow.
Named Brent S., and he submitted his question over on Twitter/X. And he wants to know, do you like the Ghostbusters movies?
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, I enjoy them. I'm not somebody who, I don't think I'm somebody who would go to them as like a repeated, like a comfort movie, you know? But I don't have a lot of comfort movies. So I enjoyed the original. I enjoyed the one with like Melissa McCarthy and stuff. That one was fine. It like I think it's always hard when you try to redo one. But the one I think did enjoy more. Wasn't there a third one with like the like guy, the kid from Stranger Things?
Yep.
I like that one, the one where they brought back that one actor via hologram.
Yep.
And I bawled.
Yeah, I cried at that one.
At that moment. That was a good one. They did a great job with that because that could have been really terrible. Like, trying to repurpose someone's idea like that, however like close you are, even if like the original creator tries to repurpose it, it can lose its magic a little bit. And I thought that they did a great job. But I don't know if I would go see the new one in theaters, because I just don't go to theaters anymore. So I might see it if it comes out.
I don't either.
On streaming, but yeah. What about you?
I remember seeing the second original movie in theaters. I was very, very young, but I have a distinct memory of the slime that came through, like, out of the drain, the pink slime. And I remember being freaked out by that for a very long time.
I remember being scared for the Jet Puff ghost.
Oh, the Stay Puff Marshmallow Man?
That guy scared the crap out of me.
I thought the one with Chris Hemsworth was fun. I wouldn't say it was great, but it was fun. It was a fun, like, reimagining of the universe. I did really enjoy the most recent one with Paul Rudd, because obviously I love Paul Rudd, and Finn Wolfhard?
Yeah,
I can't remember.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I know he's not listening, but I feel bad that I said his name wrong. But just because I thought it was a really great reimagining that tied back to the original movie with the whole, like, Gozer thing and how it brought the Stay Puft Little Marshmallow Man back. Like, there were a lot of homages to the original that I thought was really nice. So I did really enjoy it.
And it brought back a level of humanity too. Like, that it wasn't just that, it reminded you that in this universe, these were people.
Yeah.
Which I thought was, it's not easy for a lot of movies to do that with, like, kind of goofy sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
You don't really care about the people. You care about the weird situations and the entertainment. So the fact that they were able to tug at your heartstrings in a genuine way was refreshing.
And to, you know, I think give tribute to the original characters in a way where you didn't feel like it was patronizing or, like, lip service. Like,
yeah, wasn't pandering to them either.
Yeah, like, I felt like it was a decent continuation of the original story.
It was respectful.
Yeah. So thanks, Brent. I hope that was what you were looking for. Sorry for feedback.
Yeah. It's okay.
On that note, what's something good you'd like to share?
As we record this, I was laid off yesterday from my job.
Mm-hmm.
So something good. I think, honestly, my something good is that while the situation that I'm in work-wise is scary and not a great place to be, and there's a lot of unknowns, I am in the process of moving, and I was really stressed out about how I was going to be able to find time for the move and get everything together in a way where we would have plenty of time to clean up the old townhome and move into our new home. My something good is I'm kind of shifting my thinking a little bit and just taking this all in as, like, a really fresh new start, like, new career, hopefully sooner than later.
Mm-hmm.
Once I move into my new place, but a new environment without all of the, not necessarily baggage, but, you know, every job comes with its own stressors. So kind of an absence of that type of stress, and kind of going into my new home with kind of clear sights. And I was already in the process too of getting a certification that would make me a much better candidate in general, and kind of just a better employee overall, a better worker.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really excited to finish studying for that and taking that exam, and then seeing what kind of opportunities I can get from that. So as weird as it is, like, less than 24 hours since I was let go, I feel good. I think it's going to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing I have to think about now is making sure that I have good health insurance, because as somebody with a chronic illness in the United States, absence of health insurance equals scary.
Yeah.
So that's kind of one of my priorities after we get settled. But I don't know. Other than that, I think I feel a lot better than I thought I would at this point. So what about you?
I'm feeling kind of similar feelings to you in that I still haven't secured a new job. 6 months after being laid off, submitted a request for my last unemployment check this week. So I'm starting to feel very, very anxious about next steps. But kind of like you, I've been doing some certification courses for some other things that might make me a little bit more attractive to potential employers. I do have something in the works that I'm just kind of waiting to hear more about. So hopefully that will pan out to a job.
Yeah,
just trying to stay positive and also do other things to kind of get my mind off of it. Like, I'm almost building my RC car.
That is really fun.
I have a couple more things to finish, and then we get to move on to painting the body. So that'll be fun.
Oh, yeah. When I was looking for a job over a year ago, it takes forever to get in the door. And it's crazy. Like, you'll see the perfect job and you get like a rejection email.
Like immediately.
Immediately. And you're like the most qualified ever. Like, that's exactly what I do. And they're like, no, you don't.
They're like, yeah, no.
And then sometimes they ask you to apply 3 or 4 times just so you can get noticed. And it's just crazy. Like, I feel bad for recruiters at this point because I can't imagine what it's like trying to sift through that. But at the same time, also, like, hey, if you like two weird podcast ladies.
Yeah, give me a job.
If you want to hang out with us and pay us while you do it. We're around.
Yeah. If you need help with digital marketing, give me a jingle. Or shoot me an email.
Project management. Alan. Chief of staff, admin staff. I'm your gal.
All right. Shall we?
Let's do it.
If you're interested in ad-free content, consider supporting us with a one-time donation either over on Buy Me a Coffee or our Venmo page, both of which are in our link tree and in the show notes.
A great way to support the show, if you want to help us out but you can't do so financially, is to leave us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Podchaser, Good Pods, Podcast Addict, and or Audible.
Looking for more content? You can find us online at yieldcrimepodcast.com. If you'd like to see pictures from this week's episode, not to mention bonus content and funny memes, make sure to follow us on Twitter at YieldCrimePod and on Facebook and Instagram at YieldCrimePodcast. On TikTok, of course you are. Follow us at YieldCrimePodcast.
We will have a sale at our Tee Public shop next week, so stay tuned for the dates for that. And as always, I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Madison.
And we'll see you next time with another tale
as old as crime.